Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we unpack the big political stories of the week. My name is Mike Siluma. On the show this week, we'll be looking at the increasing calls for President Cyril Ramaphosa to reshuffle his cabinet in light of the state's rather ham-handed response to this month's unrest, which caused much in terms of lives and damage to our economy. We'll also be touching on the government's economic interventions to turn things around in the wake of that violence.
This econ is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the DBS bank loot?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
If corruption was an Olympic sport, they will always win gold.
This is not a shit.
Can you please come
on
in?
Of order.
This week, my guests are Unombumelelo Runji, who's a political analyst and project manager at Democracy Works Foundation, as well as Andisiwe Makinana, who's a parliamentary correspondent. Welcome to the both of you. In the wake of the recent unrest, some people call it riots, there have been calls for the president to reshuffle his cabinet. Unombumelelo, can I start with you? If you were president, where would you start?
Look, I think one of the considerations that we need to make was that it depends on how you look at the situation. The analysis has been that it was a security situation, and so obviously intelligence should have known what was going to happen. The police should have reacted preventatively to ensure that the damage could be mitigated and that this should have been preempted. And so, of course, a lot of the calls are around reshuffling the security cluster ministers and seeing how to strengthen particularly the intelligence as well as the defense and police ministries. But, of course, that's not the only, I think, major issue when we look at the unrest and the protests. When we look at the underlying cause, because these riots are actually, and the protests are actually part of a wave of protests that we've seen in South Africa since 2004. And it's really about the growing and deepening inequality that we see in the country. And so even though the looting and the protests became violent and became a security issue, this is actually more of a socioeconomic issue and matter. And so much of the change has to come in terms of the socioeconomic policies that we see in the country. And to the extent that a cabinet reshuffle is going to change that or make that better, I'm not sure that that's actually going to assist. You can shift, you know, the head of defense and the minister of intelligence, for instance, and say that they failed, to preempt this and therefore to equip police to be able to act preventatively, and therefore you put somebody else in place. But that's not actually going to deal with the root issues and the root causes of such unrest. Yes, of course, they happened under the pretext of the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma. But we do know that these kinds of protests and this kind of discontent in the country has been simmering and even bubbling over for many years now. All these different strikes that we've seen, whether it's in the mining industry, the platinum sets, the community protests that usually we call service delivery protests, the xenophobic violence or protests driven in an attack of foreign-owned shops and things like that. All of these are part of a way that signals the general discontent in society about the growing inequality, the unemployment, the unequal access to the good life that we thought that the new South Africa and the Rainbow Nation would bring to all its people.
Nompumelelo says that fundamentally, we're dealing with a socioeconomic crisis. But somebody might say, yes, but there was a political intervention that in other words, the spark that lit the fire. What's your reading?
Yeah, I agree, Mike, that it was obviously sparked by the maybe arrest of the former president. But the manner in which the state could not respond because these people didn't suddenly wake up and start burning trucks and shutting down highways. they announced it. It was out there on social media. They went on mainstream media warning that you arrest this man, there's going to be violence. So the fact that up to this day, we still do not know who are the masterminds is worrying. And Pramak, if it were to happen again this weekend, do you really think the state would be able to preempt it, to avoid it, to counter it if it does happen? I do not think so. So I think we are in a much deeper trouble than we think we are. And the fact is, I agree with Nompumelelo, we may reshuffle cabinets, but it will not address the fundamental, the issues of, I think it's capacity. I think there's politics at play. Earlier this year in January, we had an attempted insurrection in America. And within a matter of days, Americans could identify who was behind it. People were being arrested. In our country, we've got a former DJ in court. The charges are not clear, and we're supposed to be comfortable and believe that we are on top of things. It's really scary for me, because I think if those people were to try it again, they would go as far as they went last time, or even further than that.
Now, Mpumelelo, when you sleep at night, you know, given what has just been described by Andy Siwe, would you be comfortable that you are protected, that the state will protect you if something were to happen in the middle of the night? In other words, are they on top of the situation? Could it happen again?
Of course it could happen again. I completely agree, you know, with what has just been said. Remember, the capacity challenges in the state did not begin with the Jacob Zuma influenced insurrection, whatever it is that we want to call it. There have been challenges of capacity in the state for some time now, and even in the security cluster itself. If you look at the levels of crime in the country in general, and the spikes that we've been seeing in organized crimes, ticking up of cash in transit heists and things like that over the years. And the fact that we're still not on top of our violent crimes, particularly sexual crimes and things like that, in terms of prevention and protection and investigation and prosecution across the justice system. So I would not be more comfortable, about saying that we are protected, or that I could sleep better at night. I wasn't sleeping better even before this so-called insurrection, even before the looting and the riots. I mean, even before this, we've seen these tactics happening on the N3, the burning of trucks, to raise other issues. So these are not tactics that are new, that were used during this looting spree. These are tactics that are well known. And so we should have been in a position, if we did have the intelligence capacity, we should have been in a position to prevent this. If you remember as well, remember the spree of the torching of schools across the provinces in our country. It was very difficult for intelligence as well there to identify the people who were behind that. And so we saw school after school being raided, being torched, equipment taken, etc. And the intelligence could not prevent that. And the police could not be on top of that. So this is nothing new. The deterioration of the capacity of the state has been with us for quite some time. And it will continue this way until the core issues. And it's not a reshuffle that's going to sort this problem out.
Where in your view, where is the holdup? Because it seems very obvious, you know, from what you are saying and from what Andy Siwe is saying, it seems very obvious that we do have a security problem. So why in your view, what is the holdup in dealing with it? Because it seems self-evident.
Yeah, so the thing is, we cannot treat these problems as in isolation from each other. So it's not just a security problem. That's why I began by saying that we need to understand these riots and the looting within the context of the broader socioeconomic disparities in our country and the discontent. There's often this idea that it is poverty that drives crime. particularly violent crime. It's actually been, if you look at the research behind this, it's actually inequality that drives it. And if we continue with the levels of inequality that we have, and it's not just income inequality, right? It's social inequality, it's spatial inequality, that we have in our society. It's asset inequality. It's an inequality in terms of access to opportunities. If we don't begin to deal with those things, we will not be on top of our security problems. But then again, also, we need police to do what police are called to do, intelligence to do what intelligence is supposed to do. The politicization of these institutions over the last couple of decades is also problematic. Because then it is not necessarily, these institutions have not been focused primarily on dealing with these security challenges that we find in our society. But often police are now mostly sent out there to put out fires that are actually caused by these political issues, these issues that are fundamental that are not being sorted out. So police are sent to go and deal with protesters that should have been dealt with by the municipality, public officials who are in charge of the issues that they're complaining about and discontented about. And so we are seeing a security response to actually issues that are governance related and political issues and issues of socioeconomic disparities in our society.
If I'm just an ordinary lay person, an average citizen, and I say, yes, I agree, there must be a reshuffle because we can't carry on like this. We can't carry on doing the same thing and expecting different outcomes. What criteria should the president be using? In other words, would he be looking at the political consideration or political influence of particular individuals, or would he be looking simply at the skill and the qualifications and the ability to manage?
Well, I suppose, Brahma, it has to be a consideration of both experience, skills, qualifications. But, you know, I mean, I understand that both, for instance, the Minister of Defense is a military-trained person. The Minister of Intelligence, I understand, has got some background in military training and maybe intelligence training. So you would say that they are qualified politically and in terms of experience, and that doesn't seem to be working out so well for South Africa. So, but also I feel the president is limited in terms of the pool from which he has to choose his executive. So I think it's also very important to ask ourselves of the security generals that are the commissioners, the actual officials that have to be involved in operations of the state security cluster. So you have to consider that layer as well. Do we have the appropriate persons in those positions? A few weeks ago, the police minister was on TV. He was asked who is the head of crime intelligence. His response was a shocking, "I do not know." The police minister says on TV he doesn't know who is the head of crime intelligence. So we have those issues as well, that I think that's where I would go with the officials, with the people that must come in to get the job, must bring in their CVs. Are they qualified for those positions? Even before you go to the politicians. For me, it's worrying. Like, after days after the riots, Parliament had a portfolio committee meeting, the committees of police and the committees of defense. They invited the politicians, and we only found out later that neither the National Commissioner of the Police nor the KwaZulu-Natal Commissioner of Police were present in that meeting. So for me, you had a meeting of politicians, and I think in reality, there wasn't much that was going to come out of those meetings. So I think we absolutely have to go back and look at the people that are employed, not deployed, the people that are employed in these positions. And you can do whatever with the cabinet, but if you have solid, qualified, skilled people in positions, I think half your problems will be solved.
Nombumelelo, the problem seems to see, Andiswe says it sits at more than one level. In other words, it sits at the top, but also it sits fed on the chain.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that. We don't have just political problems in terms of leadership. in our government, we also have operational problems where the police don't seem to know what to do in what situation. And that's why we've seen such a crisis since, you know, if we also look back at what happened in Marikana and the response there. And again, it was very unclear where the directives were coming from in the police leadership, who was to be held accountable, and what were the expertise and what were the commands, etc. You know, so that were given. And so we've got to fix things, not just at the political level. It's actually also at the operational level. But of course, those people are also guided by the actual policy outlook of the government of the day as well. What is it that we're trying to achieve? What is it that is it that the government is actually trying to achieve? You know, and that's why I will reiterate that we cannot deal with these issues in isolation. You know, the security problem is not just a security problem in and of itself. It's created by certain conditions and a certain context on the ground, a certain context in society, in the economy. And if we don't begin to have a more coherent governance approach to these problems, we are going to see a lot of this disharmony and discrepancy in responses. And clearly the center is just not holding. You know, there's just no sense of an overarching vision and directive as to what it is that we're trying to achieve, whether it's in the security cluster, whether it's economically, et cetera. There's just this incoherence, and that's what we need to deal with.
And so, you know, just to go back a few steps, you mentioned almost as a throwaway, you know, line that the president is limited in the availability of skills or talent. I suspect you're saying, what is limiting him? I mean, he's the president, you know, he should be able to get whatever he wants.
Pramek, I was referring to the cabinet. So the president can appoint people that are members of parliament, and the constitution gives them a very tiny leeway where he can choose only two people that are not MPs to be members of his cabinet. So whatever he does, whoever he chooses, let's look at who is in parliament currently. Otherwise, he can bring in one or two people that are not in parliament. So when you're looking at who is in parliament, I don't know if you see an intelligence minister there. I don't know if you see a defense minister from the pool that is already in parliament. That's what I was referring to.
But that's frightening stuff. Nompumelelo, is that, are you seeing the same thing? I mean, that parliament has got like, what, 400 MPs, and we don't have quite the material for who can be deployed to lead effectively in government.
I actually want to frighten you more. It's even the pool is even less if you consider that we work on a partisan system. I know our president has some cabinet minister who's not from the ANC, but for such strategic roles and strategic ministries, it would have to be somebody from his party. So that pool actually shrinks a little bit more. I think, look, I mean, there'd have to be a lot more open-mindedness and creativity about how it is that the governing party, the ANC, would look at filling these positions. It shouldn't just be about the balance of forces in the, you know, in terms of the factional lines that are there in the party. If it were to be done more on the basis of qualification and capacity and strategically, perhaps there could be some talent pool. You know, I'm not going to say I'm an authority on the qualifications and the capacities and capabilities of the people who are holding all those seats in parliament, but I do think there is a limitation if you begin to view it that way and understand how it is that decisions about such critical positions are made. It would not just be the president's decision; he would have to face he'd have to consider some of the other voices and opinions and see whether or not he has sufficient support. And we know that President Cyril Ramaphosa does not have the strongest hold on the ANC and the NEC as well. So he is quite limited in terms of, you know, who he can select and who can effectively run those departments.
Okay, and now to go to the other big story of this week, which is the government's economic relief package. Andy Siwe, would you like to tell us more about it?
The Minister of Finance and his Treasury team called a press conference to sort of put figures to what President Ramaphosa had announced on Sunday, that government will throw its weight behind economic recovery, but also to assist businesses that were affected by the looting and the destruction that we saw earlier this month. So government has managed to somehow find 36 billion rand that will be used to support this economic recovery, but also to provide some relief to poor South Africans, people that at the beginning that can't even get a piece job because of the lockdown regulations. And these are the people that starting from last year were getting this social relief of distress grant of 350 rand. So government had to find that money. We are told that we didn't borrow the money from anyone, but it was just reprioritized from some programs in the government. And they will reintroduce the 350 rand grant from next month. That will run until the end of the financial year, which is March 2022. And that will come at a cost of 27 billion. So somewhere they found 27 billion to continue this this program. They will find money to make sure that the police and the army continue to keep peace and stability on the streets. This is a result of the unrest that we saw at the beginning of the month. And yeah, so, and also the South African Special Insurance Association, the state-owned insurance company, will also be paying out the claims as a result of that destruction. So, that was in the main announcement from yesterday.
No, Pumelelo, I can easily understand the financial support given to businesses, particularly small businesses, you know, many of whom, you know, as we know, might not even have been insured, you know. So one could say that you could give them a once-off injection so that you get them back on their feet and then off they go. But in terms of the social interventions, you know, in individual grants, etc., is that where our survival is going to come from? Is that where the solution is going to come from, you know, to deal with issues of poverty?
So I think what the government is basically acknowledging is that poverty is a real issue, it's a real problem. People are really struggling to put food on their tables on a daily basis. And when the economy is closed up like this and the freedom of movement is curtailed and people are unable to as freely access opportunities as they could have, perhaps if there wasn't a lockdown, you're going to have a lot of stress on households, a lot of stress on individuals. And so they're also beginning to recognize the point that I've been making is that this is not just a security problem. This is a problem that requires interventions at the social and economic level. And you've got to begin to address that. And so I think this grant is an acknowledgement of that. Of course, there are questions about whether or not it's not linked to the fact that, elections are coming up, etc. That's one thing. But I think it is important to provide this kind of a social net under these circumstances. If you looked at a lot of the reports about the people who were actually going and looting, some of those people were not opportunistic. They were looking for the basics, you know, and that shows you the level of desperation that we are seeing in the under this context. But we must also remember that these conditions for a lot of people preceded the pandemic, and so there was going to have to be some kind of intervention. There are many organizations in civil society that have been calling for a basic income grant across the board, you know, and this begins to speak to that to a certain extent. I mean, there are some questions about sustainability, et cetera, but of course, this intervention has to work together with other interventions that have to do with getting the economy going, getting more sectors that actually are labor absorbing, so that more and more young people who are actually in the job market get jobs. That needs to be accompanied by industrialization you know, and a building up of the industrial capacity of our country in manufacturing. We need to see more happening within the agricultural space. These are the more labor absorptive sectors of our economy. And so we need to see that this kind of social intervention is also going to be coupled with other economic interventions that are linked towards a long-term solution to the unemployment and poverty problem that we see that is driving actually one of the main drivers of inequality in our country.
Well, folks, that's all we have time for on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly this week. In the meantime, we wait to see what the president does, what changes he's going to introduce, and how far he's willing to go to reimagine and refashion the leadership, the political leadership of our country. We'd like to thank our guest for this week's conversation, Nompumelelo Runji, who's political analyst and project manager at Democracy Works Foundation, as well as Andiswe Makinana, who's the Sunday Times parliamentary correspondent. And by the way, you can find a podcast of this conversation on iono.fm, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma, signing off.